Hello there. Today is Friday, April 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a well-known name gets into the race for who will take on Donald Trump in 2020, saying it's a battle for the soul of the nation.
Today I'm announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
I don't see him as a threat.
North Korea sends the U.S. a bill for hospitalizing an American student it held and sent back in a coma. Also ahead, the wait is over for the opening of a long-awaited installment of a wildly popular superhero movie series. It's all on today's International Edition. Former Vice President Joe Biden made it official Thursday. He is a candidate for president in 2020. Biden is at the top of the 20-person Democratic presidential field, according to public opinion polls. He made the announcement in a video that took direct aim at President Trump.
The core values of this nation, our standing in the world, our very democracy, everything that has made America, America is at stake. That's why today I'm announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports President Trump is reacting to Biden's announcement.
The president tweets, "Welcome to the race, Sleepy Joe. I only hope you have the intelligence, long in doubt, to wage a successful primary campaign." The president warns it will be nasty, saying Biden will deal with people who truly have some very sick and demented ideas. He adds, "If you make it, I will see you at the starting gate."
All right, that is Sagar Magani reporting. Biden has failed in two previous runs for the White House and now faces questions about his age, his policy positions, and whether he can draw support from younger, more diverse Democratic Party. Joining us to talk more about Biden's entry into the presidential race and how it will impact the contest going forward is Daniel Lipman, co-author of Politico's Playbook. How are Democrats reacting so far to the announcement?
So I think there's mixed reaction. A number of Democrats thought it was a little odd that former Vice President Biden included a number of images of protesters in Charlottesville, you know, racist, you know, anti-Semites and neo-Nazis carrying those torches that became big news a couple of years ago. They thought that it was giving them a platform kind of to show that, even if he was criticizing how President Trump responded. But he rolled out a big staff as well, which contained a lot of veteran campaign staffers. He just has to raise a lot of money, and he's contending with a party that has swung leftward as Joe Biden is kind of Mr. Moderate. He's even hawkish on international affairs.
What I thought was interesting was that he chose to really, right out of the gate, go after the current president, whereas it seems like the other candidates are focusing more on what they bring. They're not really talking much about President Trump, which certainly he is a controversial figure.
There is a sense that if you make the campaign about the president, then he will lose. But when Democrats and Hillary Clinton made 2016 all about Trump, they still lost. And so as long as Trump is dominating the conversation, it's kind of a mixed bag in terms of, you know, he's setting the agenda. He's going to, you know, go hard right on immigration, and he's going to go pivot to social issues like abortion. And so that would be bad news for Democrats. And so if they have to kind of offer an alternative vision of America, and that's what Biden tried to do. They raised the campaigns now like 20 people. And so, you know, it's kind of hard to break through. But, you know, we called it Biden Day in the office because it was all about a former vice president who's still pretty close to his former boss.
Right. And, you know, he is polling at the top of the heap right now. But, of course, he was polling before he even got in. So now that he is in, will it be harder to maintain that now that he will be under a lot of scrutiny? He will be campaigning with all these other people, and it by no means will be easy, I'd imagine.
Yeah, there's going to be scrutiny in terms of his record. And he was a moderate, and, you know, he supported the banks and the credit card companies. He had pretty harsh questioning of Anita Hill during the Supreme Court hearings back with Clarence Thomas. And so there's still a lot of questions about whether he is as left and liberal than the party is moving towards.
And, you know, we have heard a lot about the fact that the party is moving to the left, but then we've seen other polls that indicate most Democratic voters ultimately vote sort of for more moderate candidates. How does Biden distinguish himself in a way that appeals to both middle-of-the-road Democrats and also some of the ideas that some of these more left-leaning voters might want to see?
Yeah, this is a huge question for Joe Biden about You know, how far to the left should he try to run in this primary? Because he still has to, he still has to move back to the right and the center, really, in a general election if he becomes nominee. Most voters and primary voters are actually thinking more about electability than whether a candidate fits all the hits all the litmus test questions. And so I think most people in the Democratic Party view Joe Biden as liberal enough. That's not a huge question. He's not the flavor of the month like Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana. He's not going to be the guy who was a Rhodes Scholar who's very young and would be the first gay president.
There are also, you know, indications, at least from many news reports, that Joe Biden is the candidate most feared by President Trump. Why do you think that is?
I think President Trump views Joe Biden as someone who can appeal to those Midwestern states where Trump won in 2016. And so those, you know, blue-collar, union, white, working-class voters, that's a target demographic for Biden. And so Biden views himself as uniquely talented to get those people on his side and away from Trump. And he can tell those people, Trump, you gave him a shot. He did not do a good job as president, and I can represent your interests.
He's calling himself an Obama Democrat. Do you think that's a good plan, or would that hurt him or help him, or we don't know yet?
Obama's still very popular among the Democratic base. You know, he's a hero to them, and so he's kind of trying to call himself an Obama-Biden Democrat. And a lot of people in the Democratic Party, they want to kind of return to a more sane president, unlike Donald Trump, who is kind of more mercurial. And so that's one reason why Joe Biden is kind of going hard on the Barack Obama card.
All right. Daniel Lipman, co-author of Politico's Playbook. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Amnesty International says the anti-ISIS coalition strikes have killed 1,600 civilians in Syria's Raqqa. The Red Cross dubs Libyan neighborhoods as battlegrounds. A judge gives the Trump administration 6 months to ID children separated at the border. And an American astronaut describes life in space. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and Russian President Vladimir Putin vowed closer ties following their first ever summit Thursday in the far eastern Russian city of Vladivostok. Kim, who's searching for economic help amid deadlocked nuclear talks with the United States, said he hopes to solidify relations with Moscow and looks forward to productive talks with Putin. Putin said he supports North Korea's improved relations with Washington and that he hopes to see closer ties with North Korea.
Well, I saw a report that said that the meeting was short on substance and long on politics and feeling. I think that's pretty accurate, but the nature of it being short on substance is important. When Kim went to Hanoi to meet with President Trump, before he went, he told the North Korean elites, especially the entrepreneurs in North Korea, that they should ramp up their plans for doing business with the outside world because he was going to get sanctions relief from President Trump. This was going to be a great victory for Kim. And they were stockpiling coal in ports and all kinds of activities, getting ready to start marketing. And when he came back from Hanoi without any agreement, there was substantial disappointment among the North Korean entrepreneurs, who are largely from the elite. And this mirrored the fact that he got very little from each of the four meetings with Chinese President Xi has done, he did since the beginning of 2018, each time of which he promised the elites, though not as strong as with the Hanoi case, that he was going to get sanctions relief. So Kim is undermining his appearance to be a god in North Korea, which is, of course, their propaganda. He got some relief from Russia. Russia promised to take more North Korean slave labor that they would pay the regime for, but not really much beyond that. And that's not going to play well again in Pyongyang. He's undercutting his image, but at least he got something. Moreover, there are at least stories that the regime is running out of hard currency, and they need to have sanctions relief to change that. And that didn't happen either. So while he gave the appearance that he was respected by Putin enough for Putin to meet with him, finally, this was not a case where he looks like he's coming back a great victor, which I think he had hoped would happen.
But does it elevate Vladimir Putin in some way and make a statement to the world about President Trump's boasting of the relationship with Kim?
Well, certainly it does, because Putin basically put on the table the return to the six-party talks. Russia has been largely out of the negotiations going on with North Korea for essentially a decade, and that doesn't play well for Putin, who wants to be a world leader. So he, and I suspect Kim, also raised the subject of six-party talks being returned to. It's not clear to me that either President Moon of South Korea or President Trump are going to want to dilute their ability to work with North Korea by also having to work with the other three parties, China, Russia, and Japan. And it's not clear to me that South Korea and the U.S. want to change that, but Russia does. They want the appearance that they're a major power. And Kim undoubtedly also wants six-party talks because he wants other voices that will support him and not just have to face directly to Trump, who is not directly supporting him the way that Kim would like, which is with pure sanctions relief.
Is there a risk, too, with world leaders meeting with Kim in such a way that normalizes who he is and what he stands for?
Absolutely. Already when he returned from the Hanoi summit, of course, the first message to the people in Pyongyang was, see, I'm a peer of President Trump. I'm his equal. He's meeting with me. He's met with me now twice. This is a great victory for me. The irony in an important statement on North Korea is shortly thereafter they had to change the story and say, well, there wasn't really an agreement. We didn't really get sanctions relief because outside information had made its way into North Korea and the elite knew that it had been a failure for Kim. And he had to explain it and not try to go with just propaganda.
And that, by the way, was Bruce Bennett. He is a senior international defense researcher with the RAND Corporation, and he will be back with us shortly on another late-breaking news story coming out of North Korea.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Well, hours after the meeting between Vladimir Putin's and Kim Jong-un Thursday, the Washington Post reported that North Korea is billing the United States $2 million for the medical care of a U.S. college student who was detained in Pyongyang in 2016 and returned to the United States in a coma more than a year later. Sources tell the Post the main U.S. envoy sent to retrieve the unresponsive Otto Warmbier signed an agreement to pay the medical bill at the direction of President Donald Trump. And back with us now is Bruce Bennett, senior international defense researcher with the RAND Corporation. Something else related to North Korea that just came out. North Korea issued a $2 million bill for hospital care of comatose American Otto Warmbier and insisted that a U.S. official had signed a pledge that the U.S. would pay for it before they would let him actually be allowed to fly home from Pyongyang in 2017. Pretty astonishing.
It is astonishing. It shows the nature of the corruption in North Korea and their desperation to get hard currency. Of course, from an American perspective, even if the Americans decided to pay that, you have the lawsuit by the Warmbiers against North Korea, and that money would be held in trust against the lawsuit. So that money is not going to go to North Korea, even if the U.S. government decided to pay it. It would be held aside to potentially compensate the Warmbiers. So President Trump may yet decide to pay it because he wants the Warmbiers compensated. It's going to be an interesting thing to watch in that term.
It just seems interesting, though, that they want money for his care of being comatose when they're the cause of it?
Exactly. That's right. But that's North Korea. North Korea basically is brutal, and they will do anything they can to get the money that they think they are due and they need. And so it's very typical of the way the North operates.
But what about the U.S.? If the U.S. did, in fact, agree to pay for his hospital care before they let the U.S. take him home, doesn't that sort of sound like we're paying to get people back and we're paying for hostages, something we supposedly don't do?
And North Korea has, with previous detainees, insisted upon the United States paying some form of hospital and other bills. So this is not new. This has happened before. And the answer is it does look like it's a certain payment for the hostages, but they would have demanded these payments even if they hadn't released the people, because these are, in their mind, services that they rendered for the people, whether or not they've been released. It's just a very corrupt system, and hard to imagine from an American perspective how anybody could accept that kind of thing, but that's the way North Korea is.
All right. Bruce Bennett, Senior International Defense Researcher with the RAND Corporation. The U.S. Embassy in Colombo has advised people to avoid places of worship in Sri Lanka over the coming weekend, citing Sri Lankan reports that additional attacks may occur. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe says the father of the two of the suspected suicide bombers has been arrested on suspicion of aiding his sons.
The father was taken in earlier. He is a leading businessman, one of the leading dealers in spices, pepper and all. he's known around the business community, active in politics, and was in the list of one of the political parties. But I do not know if he knew what his sons were doing.
Sri Lankan officials revised the death toll for the Easter Sunday bombings down by 100 on Thursday, blaming difficulty in identifying body parts at the bomb scenes and inaccurate data provided by morgues. Most of the victims were Sri Lankans, but at least 38 foreigners were also killed, many of them tourists having breakfast at high-end hotels when the bombers struck. About 500 people were wounded. Social media companies such as Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook are not legally responsible for the content that users unload to their sites. That legal protection has been key to their explosive growth, but there's a growing consensus that companies must do more to root out misleading content. Michelle Quinn reports the companies may be taking action in the hope of avoiding stricter government regulation.
It began, like so many other falsehoods on social media, as the Notre Dame Cathedral burned in Paris, fake news and conspiracy theories started to crop up on Twitter, jumped to Facebook, and percolated on YouTube. This time, however, none of them really went viral.
I think tech platforms would point to the things they're trying to do to limit the spread of misinformation as saying, hey, this is proof that what we're doing is working. Honestly, like from where I sit, I think it's really just like more people are aware that this is happening. So people are less likely to share something like right out the bat.
People are also expecting action from the companies. Facebook is collaborating with fact checkers to weed out objectionable content. Twitter has targeted bots, automatic accounts that spread falsehoods. YouTube is trying to alter its algorithm to make it harder to find problematic videos. Some say it's not enough.
What have you done to ensure that all your folks out there globally know the dog whistles and know the key words, the phrasing, you know, the things that people respond to ensure that we can stop some of this and be more proactive in blocking some of this language?
We do have 30,000 people now focused on safety and security, and within that 30,000 people, we have specific subject matter experts that focus on this area. So we have academics, we have other people who come from civil society, human rights backgrounds, who really dive deep in this area. We do use a lot of our automation and artificial intelligence to help surface, to help provide the data analysis.
Well, I hope you do more. Thank you.
Right now, there's a lot of outsourcing going on. In other words, washing our own hands of the problem rather than saying, this is a mess we've created and we are going to devote resources that will lower the profits to shareholders because it will require a deeper investment in our own company. And that at a massive level is not what's going on.
For now, human fact-checkers are using technology to monitor the sites and flag objectionable content.
They are then able to create a database now of bad actors, and they can start taking action against them, which will reduce the impressions, reduce their financial incentive, because they'll get less clicks and they'll get less advertising.
While reducing impressions slows the spread of misinformation, it also slows Facebook's growth. Does being more responsible mean making less money? Social media companies are trying to find that out. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Her lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. While Avengers Endgame marks the culmination of Marvel's superhero universe since its first Iron Man film in 2008. Critics have hailed the three-hour movie as a super spectacle and a befitting ending, hearkening back to the beginnings of the Avengers franchise. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with critics and industry insiders about the significance of the film, about its franchise, and the future of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
After a cliffhanger ending of Avengers Infinity War, where the galactic overlord Thanos reduces half of Earth's planet life to dust, the second installment, Avengers Endgame, is the final chapter of the Avengers franchise, bringing together all the superheroes of the Marvel Universe in a final battle against the omnipotent Titan. Washington Post comic book culture reporter David Betancourt says the film is expected to be the blockbuster of all blockbusters.
Endgame is the final chapter of something we've never seen before, which is a connected narrative through multiple film franchises over the course of a decade. This will be the 22nd Marvel Studios film.
But what elements create a blockbuster of such magnitude? Above all, according to Paul Rudd, who plays Ant-Man, it is the characters.
These characters are archetypes. And the emotional resonance, the relationships they have with one another, and it's really the main thing that makes the movies work.
Then there's the storyline, says Thor actor Chris Hemsworth.
I think it's the darkest in some ways, the sort of wackiest in other ways. It feels like there's a real sort of drama at the core of it, you know, a sort of small indie character-driven sort of drama on one hand, and then coupled with it being the most expensive, biggest, visually stunning, smorgasbord effects-driven film you could ever imagine.
A blockbuster could not be without an unexpected ending, says Avengers pioneer Iron Man actor Robert Downey Jr.
The last 8 minutes of that movie are maybe the best 8 minutes in the entire history of the whole run of them, in a way, you know, because everyone's involved.
Plot and characters aside, a blockbuster is about money, says Hollywood insider Stephen Paterno.
Disney, with the Marvel Universe and the Star Wars Universe, are, and never mind Pixar and all their family-friendly animations there, clearly have a blockbuster factory. And so, yes, that is generating billions, if not 10-plus billion dollars in theatrical revenue, but then it drives television and theme parks and action figures and the rest.
Movie theaters across the country offered marathon screenings of all 22 Marvel Cinematic Universe movies leading up to the premiere of Avengers Endgame.
Endgame, just based off of the pre-sales and the hype, it wouldn't surprise me if it inched towards $3 billion.
Dollars, that is. The end of the Avengers franchise also signals a new phase of Marvel Universe, featuring a more ethnically diverse superhero universe, says Betancourt.
You have Black Panther, it made $1 billion. You have Captain Marvel, it made $1 million. Marvel Studios is now in pre-production on an all-Asian ensemble for an Asian superhero that they have in their ranks. They've proven that there's an audience for those type of heroes. Not only an audience, but that the same audience you were treating with those initial Avengers movies wants to see those type of movies as well.
Hey, Ms. Potts. If you find this recording, don't feel bad about this. Part of the journey is the end.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Fresh off his Broadway run, New Jersey's Bruce Springsteen, The Boss, looked west for inspiration on a new album he's planning to release on June 14th. The 13-song disc is his first new studio album in 5 years. Titled Western Stars, Springsteen said Thursday the album draws some inspiration from Southern California pop records of the late 60s and early 70s. He's released a song and video called Hello Sunshine after midnight Thursday. Springsteen wrapped up a 236-show Broadway run last December. He recorded this primarily at home in New Jersey with additional work in California and New York. Ron Agnello produced and played on the album, which also has contributions from Springsteen's wife and longtime associates.
When they let me in, I wanna be your friend. I wanna guard your dreams and visions. Just wrap your legs.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Nashwan Kale. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. I'm
This is VOA